Good afternoon, everyone. Allison Skaberg here with Consolidated Planning Group. Thanks for joining us today. If you are planning your day, we will be going for an hour today. Consolidated Planning Group is a holistic special needs financial planning firm. We're nationally certified as Social Security advisors, members of the Special Needs Planning Academy. We help people plan and navigate the future for their loved one with a disability, knowing when and how to apply for public benefits, how to maintain eligibility for said benefits. And we do a lot of educational webinars and podcasts surrounding planning for a loved one with a disability. All of our past meetings live on our Consolidated Planning Group YouTube channel. We have over 400 webinars carefully titled that you can search the topic for the planning step that you are on. We also have our podcast series, which you can find on Spotify and RSS as well. I always like to go over a few housekeeping items before we get started. We are in webinar mode today, which means that we can't see you or hear you. Today's meeting is being recorded, and you will get an email later with a link to the recording and also a copy of a PDF of the slides. So if there's any links or any important information, I always like to mention that because you don't have to take notes on everything you hear today because you are going to get those slides. We invite everyone to put their questions in the chat box today. I'll be monitoring that, the questions, and we'll get to as many questions as we can within the time that we have together here today. So without further ado, I am going to move forward to Sarish Shikaparia. Tried my best, that is quite a last name. I'm happy to have her here with us today. And she is gonna talk to us about navigating higher education after high school. And I know that this is a topic that is near and dear to a lot of people's hearts, and kind of figuring out where is my child gonna go, or what programs could they thrive in after high school? And maybe after high school for your child is age 18, maybe after high school for your child is 21, maybe your child is ready for this at 27, and there's not a magic age on all of these things. And so just knowing that the options are out there, the options are many, including for individuals who have an intellectual disability. And so I'm really glad you're here and you are here with us today. This is the first time that we have done this particular topic with Sarish. So Sarish, thank you for being here with us today, and we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you so much, Allison, for the warm welcome. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. I'm really excited to be here. I come to you from University of Maryland. I'm here out in the DC area, but I have very strong ties to Texas. And I'll sort of go ahead and share our agenda for today. So today, again, I'm going to just briefly introduce myself, welcome you all, talk a little bit about some graduation options. Then we're going to transition into what higher ed may look like for your youth with intellectual and or developmental disability. And then we're going to do a focused deep dive into what inclusive higher education options look like. I'm going to give you a deeper analysis of what the application process looks like, what questions to ask, what the processes look like, giving you a very well-equipped resource guide, essentially. So just based on my background, I graduated from Emory University in Atlanta. I'm originally from Atlanta, did my master's in London in secondary education. And then comes A&M, where I did my PhD more recently, and I also taught in Texas. I taught both in Austin and Houston for several years in middle school, particularly in the special ed field. I want to introduce you to my lovely dog, who you may hear in the background, hopefully not, he's sleeping at the moment. And then more importantly, some of my work looking at transition planning more specifically within an equity-driven focus. Okay, move forward to the next slide, please. So here, I'd like to offer you why I really got into transition. When I mentioned that I was teaching in middle school, and I realized working alongside many students and families that they really weren't sure what their child was going to do after leaving high school. They knew kind of what they were going to do in around the high school time, what skills they might focus on, but they weren't sure how that would translate into the real world after leaving high school, and more importantly, what supports might be offered afterward. And this is something I actually noticed in my personal experience. So I'm actually a sibling of an individual with autism. And as we were thinking about her future, it kind of felt like we were at a standstill, almost on top of a cliff, essentially, where it was really scary to look down. And it felt like we were given a lot of support until the cliff came. And then once that peak happened at the age of 21, 22, it felt like we were asked to push. We were kind of being pushed down without being offered much support or guidance or any cushioning to back the fall. And this is where my interest really comes through, is helping families like myself, like the families I've worked with for many, many years, thinking about what supports are offered, particularly in the realm of higher education, and how to leverage those supports while your child might be still in high school looking ahead. And finally, thinking about what opportunities are ahead is really important and something that is driven by my personal and professional work. Thinking more importantly about the many layers of having a meaningful life after graduating high school. And while inclusive higher ed may be one of them, there might be many more tied into that to think about, you know, a little bit more toward higher quality of life as well once the individual graduates from high school. So let's do a deep dive into what graduation options in Texas really look like. So in the next slide, you'll see three different tiers. The first tier is going to look at what a typical graduation options look like, where you pass the STAR test, you spend majority of the time in general education, and you walk out with a regular high school diploma. This also means, if it's a typical and stated as such, that there are no more special education services after you graduate with this distinction. However, I know majority of the students, particularly those students with IEPs, might qualify under the modified version, which means that you will complete the requirements from IEP. The STAR requirements will be determined by your R team, as well as you will continue to receive special education services after graduation. So that might fall into an 18 plus program, which allows your child to stay in high school essentially until the age of 21, 22. This also leaves the child with a regular high school diploma. Now, a third option might be more of a certificate option, where the student receives a certificate and they typically age out of the system. So they will still stay in high school until the age of 21, 22, but it will not count as a high school diploma. And the reason I point this out early is so that family members can really think more strategically about the goals and what will lead to the goals in high school. If you want, like your child, or if the child, the youth prefers to have competitive employment, if they prefer to be in higher education, if they prefer to get vocational training, sometimes having a high school diploma is set at a standard. So this is something to be cognizant of and really collaborate with your R team to ensure that the goals are meeting the graduation options. And I'll touch a little bit more on this as we move forward. We can go ahead to the next slide, please. So this is just a brief comparison of what it means to have a high school diploma versus a certificate. Again, both offer accommodations. Both may or may not be accepted by colleges, and we'll talk a little bit more about the nuance of that, particularly within inclusive higher education options. Both may or may not be accepted by employers. And generally, a high school diploma generates ability to have federal funding for college versus a certificate may not. And again, both allow the individual to stay past the age of 18 if an 18 plus program is offered in high school until the age of 21, moving into 22. So I would like you to pause here and think about what questions you could talk to, what questions you could ask your ARD committee to really prepare strategically for graduation. Think about asking them what option is best to really meet my child's not just educational, but daily living and employment goals. We want to make sure that, you know, it may be that you, that the youth may not be looking for employment. The youth may be looking for a group home. The youth may be looking for a very different lifestyle that suits them, that does not require a high school diploma. So think about what the needs are and make sure those needs are being matched in the conversations you are having with your ARD committee. For instance, I mentioned this idea of an 18 plus program, and they can be really helpful in preparing individuals for daily living skills, thinking about internships, employment, being out in the community. But before really thinking about what's offered, think about what is the program going to focus on, and how, what will my child's schedule look like in a day 18 plus program? For instance, Fort Bend County has a great 18 plus program. Houston ISD has one. Katy ISD has one. And I've heard from several parents that while they may be really helpful in some instances, in some they might not be. A parent recently came to me and said, I have in my 18 plus program, my 21-year-old son actually watches movie 3 days of the week. And if he's just watching a movie, I could do that at home. So then we went back and talking about what the goals of the program are, how are the goals being embedded? What does your advocacy look like in that process? And think continuously about what higher education programs would support your young adult's needs after high school. So just a good slide for you to have some beginning conversations with the ARD team if you haven't already started thinking about these layers.
Can you give us some feedback? Because I know that we talk to a lot of families, and a lot of families are already on this and they're already aware of the 18 plus programs. They're definitely aware that their child can stay in high school post age 18. But then we also have come across many families that aren't aware. And we are proponents of intentional conversations. If you have that intention of these 18 plus programs, when do these conversations need to start? And let's just say we had somebody here that's listening that maybe was late to the party on these conversations. What recourse do they have so that way they can get back on track with an 18 plus or, you know, some of these programs?
That's a really good question. So if you are still early in the phase, the age 14 is our mark. We always say start at 14 because that's when transition planning legally starts in Texas. Now, if your child has, let's say, left the high school, and now they're perhaps at home or doing something in the community, and you want them to go back in, that might be a little bit of a harder track, because in the school, and you have determined they don't need to be serviced by the school anymore. However, you can make the case, like, for example, a lot of parents made the case during the early days of the pandemic about regression of skills while they were at home. So it was necessary for the schools under FAPE, which is free appropriate education, to be able to service those needs. Now, if your child is 18 and the ARD team has shared that perhaps it's time for your child to graduate, this is the perfect time to say, hey, let's pause on this for a second. Let's see if there's other skills that we can continue to provide my child with until the age of 21, 22, when they might be ready to move out of the system. And I would strongly suggest these be written as goals that are data-driven in your IEP team meeting plan. So for instance, a goal is for my child to have experiences with community integration at the age of 18 or 19, so they know. Or it could be, I want my child to be able to do budgeting or money management. And this is something that the school can work on. They can take them to HEB, they can take them to Kroger and see what kind of, what am I spending? How am I spending it? What does it look like to engage in those social skills while they're learning budgeting skills? So that, you know, I unfortunately, a lot of the effort is placed on the family members to make the case for that. But I highly, highly say that you should make the case if you think your child can benefit being in high school for a longer time. Another thing I'd say is you can switch your 18 plus program if you feel like they're not giving you or meeting your goals. And that is something that we say you can fall under alternative placement, where you can request that, and legally they have to provide you with an alternate placement that offers you free and appropriate education. Emphasis on appropriate.
I love that you said that, the alternative education, and I love that you talked about like having this conversation in the ARD meetings. And sometimes we hear of great ARD meetings and not so great ARD meetings. We hear of things where the school is like, quote unquote, maybe pushing the student out or whatever. And it's okay to use your words and use your voice if you feel strongly that the child should stay there. And then I just wanted to comment from a financial perspective. When it comes to caring for a loved one with a disability, we have a lifetime of paying for these kids, and they're entitled to a free, you know, public education. So a lot of our kids with disabilities are behind the curve, maybe from a maturity level or from an education level and some of the skills levels that you were talking about. So if they are enjoying, they're thriving, they have community in the school and they're learning, there's no reason not to say, hey, we want them to stay into 21. Maybe you take them out at 20, or maybe you take them out at 19 or whatever, but you've made the case that they could stay longer should they want to. And then the alternative, because I've heard of some families saying, no, my kid hates this school, it's not going well, you know, things are bad here, and the sooner we get out of there, the better. So requesting, before we move on to the next slide, can you just, for anybody here that may be the case for them, and they were thinking of leaving at 18 because of that scenario, how do they make a request for an alternative placement?
Yes, good question. So you would write a notice to your district, first your IEP team, and then to your case manager, and then the district, and essentially say, this is the data. This is how my son or daughter's goals are not being met through the data that's being collected by the school. And under the law of FAPE, we need to have appropriate free education. Right now, the education is not appropriate, and we need alternative placement. And then they have around a time, it depends on the school districts, but typically they should do a turnaround in 45 days or so, get back to you and say, hey, this is what we can offer, or instead of this is how we're going to support you in this school. Oftentimes they can say, try it for another 6 weeks, stay firm, say, I need an alternative placement, and then continue to ask for that and use the law of FAPE to do that.
And then the key message now is, because we're nearing the beginning of May and towards the end of school for the school year, so getting these requests in now so placement can be appropriate for the next school year, it would be a wise move, correct?
Absolutely. Yes. We have 3 more weeks, 3-ish, 4-ish, depending on where we are. Yes, that would be wise. So then we'll kind of think now about this law, IDEA, right? Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, insisted that we focus on post-secondary education after graduation from high school. And this related to two essential components of training and education. Training, thinking about a certificate, vocational training, and then education, really deep dive into 2-year, 4-year colleges or inclusive post-secondary education programs. And then we can move on to the next one. And the reason I bring this up is for us to pause and think about what services these may require. So after graduation, exiting high school, the Americans with Disabilities Act kicks in, which requires you to have a 504 plan and a summary of performance if you want to enroll in higher education or for some employment services that might give you ADA services. So around the age of 14, 15, make sure you start thinking very strategically about graduation options. Ask for a functional vocational evaluation. These evaluations come in dozens. There are a lot of them. And you can have the IEP team run a few of them with your child starting the age of 14 to think about what could be a good career for them. What could be a good option? Do they like working with their hands? Do they like being in social communities? Do they like working independently? But all in all, I just want all families to remember that without a goal, there is no outcome. And I highly stress establishing these as goals, measurable goals that then relate to outcomes. And if the outcomes are not met, we can go back with that data and say, hey, these are not met over a certain period of time. We need to think about alternative options. And then we can move on to the next slide, please. So we're going to deep dive into this education component of IDEA, looking at higher education and particularly inclusive post-secondary education programs. We've realized as a community of researchers and teachers that many families don't know a lot about inclusive post-secondary education programs, and we thought this would be a great opportunity to share some of the benefits as well as some of the drawbacks of programs like this and see how it may be relevant to the educational experience of your child. So this IPSE, as we call it, is actually a program that was designed from the Higher Education Opportunity Act back in 2004 to think about strategically college options for young people with intellectual and or developmental disabilities. Each program has a different cost, a requirement. They could be residential, non-residential, and may have different outcomes. Not all of them have a degree, so you know, not all of them will provide a college degree, but they may provide a certificate that may open doors for some employment opportunities. Most may also require a high school diploma, going back to our earlier conversation, and may ask of certain skills of the students to have. So Think College is a national center in UMass up in Boston, thinking about having 333 post-secondary programs around the country. They've established them, they run them, they offer a lot of data on them. If you get a chance after the webinar, please go ahead and go on their website. And there are now 17 of these programs in Texas. So in the next slide, I'll sort of talk a little bit more about what these programs entail. So as you can see on this map, they're everywhere. So wherever you pick, but Texas has a good host of them. They're an opportunity for students with IDD to go to college, regardless of their test scores and sometimes high school diploma. They offer an inclusive college experience, the ability of the young adult to be part of sororities, to be part of fraternities, to be part of social clubs, to have a community of people around them. Oftentimes, for a lot of folks, this community comes from employment. It also comes from your higher education experience. If you think back to your time when you were in college, some of your best friends might be in college. Some of your best friends were from high school. And this offers youth with IDD the same kind of experiences without limiting them to just the academic sense. They also offer an expansion of peer networks and support systems, which I think is really important when we think about a high quality of life. They also offer modified academics. So the students may take an undergraduate class for pass or fail. They also offer typically a one-on-one peer support network. So other undergraduate students that have signed up to be one-on-one peers, maybe support youth with academic skills, maybe support them with healthy eating, maybe support them in finding things to do on the weekends. They also think about adulthood skills. I mean, thinking back, a lot of the skills that we learned were in college, right? Doing laundry independently, making some food on our own, figuring out what we do on the weekends, figuring out what choices we want to make, right? When we think about doing our homework versus attending a social gathering. And so it offers more natural supports and opportunities to really build those skills. And finally, most of these programs are geared toward employment training. So they might have components that offer students internship experiences, employment training, competitive employment training as well, the ultimate goal being to have a job once you exit. And we're going to talk deep dive into a lot of what this means moving forward. So we can move on to the next slide, please.
And I just had a quick question. Yes. Are you aware of programs? I sometimes call them the middle kids, not really your middle kid, but the kid that doesn't really fit the bill. They don't have an intellectual disability, but maybe they have high functioning autism or ADHD or executive functioning issues. And so they don't really fit one end or the other. Are there programs that are good fits for kids that are kind of along those lines?
Yes, that's a good question. So one of the programs I'll zoom in on here with the VAST Academy actually looks at some of those students, and I will talk about them in the next two slides. So please remind me if I forget. These are just a look at some of the 17 programs offered in Texas. As you can see, they're very diverse across the state. North Texas, we have in Austin, College Station, Houston, pretty spread out. And then we can, when we move on to the next slide, we'll sort of deep dive into some of these. Before we take a look at each individual one, I want you to maybe step back and think about a little bit of Allison's question as well, but think about who might benefit from the IPSE experience. It might be young adults between 21 and 27, typically, and I'll show you some of the requirements. Typically, they have an intellectual and or developmental disability. And I put an asterisk on this as a caveat because you'll see some may be more suited for that middle child as well. They are typically young adults who desire to go to college, who want to work after college, who can do some tasks independently. They can bathe, they can shower, they can probably administer their own medicines, they can take a campus bus, maybe they can shuttle, maybe they can use Uber on their phone. They might be young adults who are also mostly their own legal guardians, and you'll see the requirements of this across different programs. And they also want to make friends. They're also people who want to engage in a social community. They want to hang out. They want to have a sense of belonging. And then in the next slide, we'll sort of get an idea of what this looks like in real time.
I just wanted to mention, because you brought something up on the last slide on that guardianship, they're their own guardian or whatever. That is a pro tip right there. When you're looking at programs for your kids, there are definitively some programs out there that if your child is under a full guardianship, they will not take them. So that is a good question to add to your spreadsheet of questions to always ask, so that way you don't get too far down the path and then find out that it is not an option.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I want to step back a little bit and think about what your role means, right? Oftentimes we think of what the student or the young adult may need, but I also want you as family members to think about what your role may need and what your capacity may be for these programs, right? Remember, now we're transitioning from you being super hands-on in K through 12 and being strong advocates to now you taking more of a back seat if your child might be enrolled in one of these programs. We do something that's noted as person-centered planning, which means that we look at the student's goals, the student's visions very prominently, and the whole experience is centered on them. So parents end up becoming the facilitators of decision-making. We also switch, remember we made that switch to ADA, but we also switched to FERPA, which I'm sure that you can experience from some of your other children, where you may not have information readily accessible about the student's grades, what decisions they might be making, why they received an F in a class, you know, so some of those decisions might be more hands-off, but your role might then be to be a sounding board for these courses. It can be, hey, this is a great opportunity. You want to take a course on Texas barbecue? That sounds fantastic. And then also letting go some of that anxiety and extending your trust to educators, faculty members, program staff, and then the peers, the undergraduate and graduate peers who support these students. And finally, I would love for you to think a little bit about this concept of dignity of risk, right? When we think about when you send off your kids to college, you sort of are a little bit anxious, but you know that they're going to be okay, right? Same thing here. When I know you've been so hands-on for 12, 22 years, now we ask you to take a little bit step back. You know, they might fail a class. They have to be accountable for that. They have to be responsible for it, and there might be consequences. There might be, like I had a student, I used to work for an IPSE program, and I had a student who decided that he was not going to go to his employment. And the parent wanted to encourage, but the parent couldn't sit there and watch him go to the employment. He had to do that on his own. And then we have to think about what is the division of responsibility. And that's something in terms of when we say adulting, this is an aspect of that. And if you are ready to let go and deliver a little part of that, this might be a great opportunity for an IPSE program as well. And if not, there's always time to prepare for that. And the time could be now as well. Now that you know in advance, there's more opportunities to prepare for that experience.
Can you give us some insight on how we could determine how, you know, which IPSE program might be a good fit?
Yes, very good question that will be answered in the next few slides. And Allison, your question too. It's coming. So again, each program differs by its location, its size, how long it lasts, the cost, as well as what it offers in terms of academic and residential placement. All of these factors are really important, and we're going to knock some of them down by looking at some of these programs in detail. So let's look at some sample eligibility requirements. What does it take to get in? And this is a good opportunity to see which IPSE program might be good for your youth. So again, this is an example of Aggie Achieve. It's a four-year residential program. It mandates that students live on campus for the first 2 years, and the second 2 years, students can kind of choose where they would like to live. Now, this is for students between ages 18 to 27. Again, it says they must be their own legal guardian. They must have an intellectual disability or autism. They can live independently. They have to demonstrate at least a third grade reading level. They can function independently, sit in a class for 90 minutes, basic maths, use a calculator. If you think further down, they must have proof of health insurance. They must administer their own medicine, and they must navigate campus safely. Now, if these check marks apply, this could be a good fit. If not, there may be other programs that might be better fit out of the 17. So for Houston Community College, now I think a program like this could be a really good opportunity for that middle kid because it is 18 to 25. They must graduate with a high school diploma. Remember, the other one didn't require that. They must complete formal admissions. Then they need to have a certain grade academic level on tests, reading, math, writing. So this might be good for somebody who might have a strong suit in more academics, but then might struggle in some of the social or behavioral skills, perhaps. They can function independently in a classroom. They can follow the code of conduct. And then again, this is only for 2 days of the week. So different cohorts, and they have a Monday, Wednesday cohort for those who want to kind of get some prereqs to go into a four-year college program as well. And then this is the Elevar program. This is in North Texas. This is similar to Aggie Achieve in Texas A&M, but a little bit different. Again, this age range is 18 to 28 versus Aggie Achieve was 27. So this adds an extra year. They must have completed high school. Diploma is not required. So with or without. They also say that the students must be served by IDA. They don't receive support from high school. So if your child is in an 18 plus program, they can't go to UNT Elevar. They must have basic functioning skills. Then it has personal interest to attend college, able to live communally and independently with other students. They are gonna, it looks like they are going to, check to see your ability, the student's ability to live communally with other students. They might provide an overnight camp as part of the admissions process. And we'll talk a little bit about all of the admissions process for these. They can also function independently. Look at this one as well. It says develop, display skills to manage stress, adapt to change. For some of our folks, this might be really, really hard, right? Especially like I think of my students with autism who really function on scheduling, and you know, college is sometimes very haphazard. Classes change, things change, our room changes, right? Sometimes you get a notice 30 minutes before the class starts that the location has changed. So this is kind of what they're assessing for. And if they might see that the child may meet some of these criteria, this could also be part of their goals in the program to improve on some of these skills. And then again, at the bottom, you see that they must serve as their own legal guardian. Those who might have supported decision-making are, you know, considered based on the conversations, and then limited history of disruptive or aggressive behavior. So three very different programs and three very different eligibility criteria. Again, you have almost 17 to choose from in Texas, and all of them differ based on, do you want them to have a residential experience? Do you want it to be more academic based? Do you want it to be more social skills? Do you want to have an opportunity, how far away they might be from home as well, which is a good consideration. Do you want it to be accessible to home, or do you want to have a little bit of space and let them grow a little bit too? And I have some questions that you can ask any of these programs when you do visit, either online, email, in person as well.
You mentioned that if a person is, has, I think, I want you to clarify that if they've attended an 18 plus program, this is not a good fit.
Sorry. No, I apologize for that. So if they are currently in an 18 plus program, they can't do this simultaneously. They can attend an 18 plus and come back. Yeah. And do this after. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. I wanted to make sure on that.
Okay, so what does it take to apply, which is very different? And we're going to compare typical application process in a four-year institution and then what it looks like in IPSE. So in IPSE, similar to a regular college admission, you have an application deadline. Typically, it's in October, sometime in December too. They might have an earlier deadline if you are applying for funding and things like that. We'll talk a little bit more about what the costs look like too. Some of them have webinars that are recorded online, similar to the consolidated group, where they have webinars on their website and you can kind of click, watch what all of the things they offer. They might also have an open house. A lot of them do it in the summer. So look out for that, where they would have a call for open house, where you come in, you visit the staff, you see all the things. They might also include a diverse application process. So they might ask for a video interview. They might ask to showcase the creative works. They might ask for a written interview or a written example. They might say, write a paragraph about your experience, or they might say, create a 30-second video. So the application materials are also going to be diverse and hopefully offer a lot of modifications and accommodations. The interview process after the application is multi-step, typically depending on the program. So for instance, in Aggie Achieve at Texas A&M, they might have a first interview with the student. They meet for 30 minutes on Zoom. Then they might have a second layered interview with the student and a family member to just get a sense of what's going on, what the goals are between the family member and the student. And then they might also offer you to a selected group to come spend 2 days in the summer to see how you and how the student engages overnight. What does that look like in following campus protocol? What does it look like when schedules change? So to really make sure this is the right fit. And again, it also, if you realize going through the process that this is not the right fit, it's a good idea, right? To then back out and say, hey, I thought this was a good fit, but it's not. Maybe another program might be a better opportunity. Then there's also this opportunity of cost, right? So if it's a CTP, which means that it has opportunity for federal funding based on your income, you might get some sort of funding for the program. Now, it's going to be very limited. Again, maybe 5 to 7% of the cost of the program, but it is there. Then if a program is TIPSED, which is a federal grant offered to some of the larger programs, they may have a little bit more money, but again, it might end up being based on your income and things like that, family income, as well as maybe the student's income. So look for CTP or TIPSED programs because they might offer some aid, but again, relatively, this is gonna be very little aid. Also think about housing options. If it's a residential program, what does that look like on campus, off campus, living with roommates? And then thinking about it. So before you start going, before you start in the fall, let's say the team, the staff will meet with the student for a person-centered plan. So make a whole plan of the next year and the 4 years, whatever that looks like for them, and then involve the family and make the plan with the family. And then they review it at the end of the year and then every year to make sure you're still meeting the goal. So it's kind of like a more independent IEP, essentially.
I just wanted to mention, we've done webinars before with Bloom Consulting in Texas, and they have a Campus Connection program, which is a wraparound program that works directly with the student and helping them hone their skills and do life without relying on mom and dad for everything, because quite honestly, most of them don't want all of the feedback that the parents give anyway. So it kind of takes the parents a little bit out of the equation and gives them some autonomy to do life and practice this adulting. But there are, so if you're, my point is if your child isn't quite there yet, some of these wraparound programs kind of go alongside. They may live on campus, but they have some help. And those TRIO programs are another program that might be helpful as well. And one thing that you mentioned earlier that I just wanted you to hit on, because I am reminded that even many, many neurotypical kids that go to college for the first time fail a class. They might fail all their classes at first. And it doesn't mean that we should hang it up and it's over, that, you know, they're just not cut out for college. What is that, you know, the timeline or dipping the toe in, you know, for an individual with a disability, or what should parents expect as this is, hey, this is normal, don't freak out?
Everything under the umbrella. You know, we've seen it all, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But Everything in terms of maybe not waking up to class or not attending, missing interviews. But I think whereas a typical college experience that's not a VNIPSE program offers more autonomy for the youth, these programs really offer more accountability. So they might have a few rules, right, around if you miss more than two classes, this might be a consequence. If you miss more than one interview, there might be a consequence, because we want to make sure that it's a supported level of autonomy. So we want to make sure that we're offering students a lot of support while saying, hey, these are the consequences, which I think a lot of times college students kind of don't get unless they fail an extenuous amount of classes. And then it's kind of like you have to exit. So think about it as a system of accountability where they're being supported throughout the experience. So thinking now about when you might go into this process, what kind of questions you could ask during the admission time? So maybe what does a typical cohort look like? Typically, there's going to be 5 to 7 or even as much as 10 people per cohort. Again, about guardianship, like I mentioned earlier, it may or may not be listed on their website, age requirements, and what's the cutoff for the age too. Like I know one of them said 28. Now, what if it's 1 month until they're turning 29 before the application? What does that look like? Reading and writing requirements. And then when I said about deferring application, there've been many cases where parents and students go through the application process and then they kind of say, hey, I think a year would really give me time to prepare. And it might look like an external preparation service or another conversation with the family to say like, hey, maybe like give it 6 more months and let's see, let's work on these 3 skills and then let's come back to the table. Because I think one of the biggest things we see is when parents and students are sometimes, you know, there's a lot of, let's say, behavioral concerns or concerns about elopement, and they enter these programs and then they say, and then, you know, there might be a safety issue that comes up where a young adult has sort of eloped and we kind of don't know where they are, right? It's really dangerous for everybody. So what I'm proposing is that take your time, gather all the information and see which program or experience might be the best and might fit your needs a little bit more. So you can always, in some programs, they let you defer it to a year. If you go through the process and by the time, you know, you go to the final interview and you're like, oh, maybe not for me, or I want to wait it out and see, or the individual might be, you know, just coming out of an 18 plus program and they're 21, 22, and you're like, maybe a year. I have, you know, a few years, maybe a year. I had a student who went through the process and they're like, you know, I kind of want to get some work experience before doing this. And then they found a part-time job at this local bakery. They did that. And then they came back and they felt like they were more prepared with a stronger vision for what they wanted to do after the 4 years of graduation. If we can go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So now let's look at the application materials. I mentioned that they were very diverse depending on the accommodations and modifications offered. Ask them in advance what type of materials are required. And then this is a really good one to pause and think about how much of the responses in the application materials should be coming from the student versus from the parent. And I say this because let's say if there's something that offer, you know, something that says you have to fill it out, right? The emphasis is that the student should be filling it out. You know, I had an experience where we had a form that was filled out, which said, you know, all the wonderful things. And it was written, it was done really well. And then it said, I want to have a job. I want to make friends, more about the disability. And then when the student came in for the interview, they're like, I don't really want to have a job. I don't think I can do a job. I don't think I want to. Then the student said, you know, I don't really want to live on campus. I don't want to be here. This is not something I see myself doing. And so there was a huge discrepancy, right? And so that discrepancy is something that the staff is going to identify at some point. So make sure that the responses, whatever they are, should be from the student, or it could be guided by the parent. So some of the application materials include like videos, and we can see in the back, the parent is like, you know, asking the questions and prompting the student, but then the responses are coming entirely from the student. And I think that shows more of a desire to attend some of these programs. And that's something that the staff really wants to see. There might be opportunities, like I had a student who was an artist, and he wanted to be an entrepreneur, make his art, sell his art after going through this experience. And so he included some artworks of his and how he wanted to, and he had a video about how he wanted to sell them. And, you know, so there might be an opportunity to add additional things to the application materials to really center on the wonderful things that the youth is able to do and already doing. Oh, and then also ask the program staff for some sample application materials. They might have materials from other past students that you might be able to see and get some guidance from as well.
And the key pro tip here that I heard is admissions offices and officers are hip to parents doing things for their students. They can spot that a mile away, so don't do that even if you're tempted, right? What do you think about parents hiring a service to help improve essays or things like that, are, you know, before submission?
That's a good question. Do you think that the student might be able to recreate that during the interview? That might be something to consider. And then the other thing I would say is think about, think about that skill then being extended when the student is in the program. You know, it's kind of like when you say it's not about just getting married, but staying married sometimes. So it's about not just getting in the program, but then how will the students succeed once they're in the program? Once they are, let's say, in a class that asks them to use a calculator, and they might not be there because they received extra support and services. So I think keep it as authentic as you can, because then the experience will be reflected on the student's experience once they enter into this, you know? So you want to go in with this is what they can do, and this is what the program staff is going to do to support them. Now thinking about the costs and the finances. So again, I mentioned CTP. So if a program is CTP, which means the student may be eligible for some federal aid, or if it's a TIPSED program, which means that there might be federal grant that the program has gotten to offer some funding to students. Ask about the total cost of attendance, and then what can you expect to pay beyond the total cost? If a student needs to go somewhere and they can't, they choose not to, or they are unable to use the bus or the shuttle, and they're gonna Uber, that might be an extra cost that we might not think of. Or eating out on the weekends, or you know, going to events on campus. So think about the total cost is what am I paying, not just to the program or the university, but also for them to have different experiences, right? And then think about opportunities for paid work. This is, you know, some of our students actually work on campus. They have a part-time job or a full-time job, depending on their the hours that they choose to work. And think about how those funds, are the money going directly into a student's direct deposit? It can't go to a parent because the student is making that money. But think about the use of that. So again, this is where dignity of risk comes in. I had a student who's working a part-time job, and every single cent was going to Chick-fil-A. Everything that she made ended up at Chick-fil-A. And you know, the parent was really upset that everything that the student was earning was going back into eating Chick-fil-A. And that was something that, you know, we can ask the students to, but we can't privy the parents on controlling that aspect of it. So, you know, think about some of those, as you're thinking about these things with your child, think about having some of those conversations at home prior to it. And then thinking about campus community. So asking about social opportunities, thinking about what peer mentorship organizations are available, what courses are offered, and what if my student is interested in music and music classes are not part of it. Is that something that you guys can build capacity with other faculty to offer? And then this is really important. Often we don't think about if the students are graduating from an IPSE program, what does the graduation look like? Do they walk with other students? Let's say in terms of Texas A&M, do they get a ring? Do they receive alumni benefits? Because they are technically alumni of the university. So what does that look like? And is that important to you and the student? And then finally, you know, think about your roles as well. Think about having that honest conversation when you do attend the open houses or browse through some of the programs. What is expected of you as a parent? How often and in what format does the program staff communicate with you? When are they available to communicate? Remember, you might not have access to student grades, but there might be an opportunity for them to send you updates. There might be a way that they do that. There might be a whole team of folks that work on parent engagement. What kind of information are they not able to offer? And how can parents visit? You know, I had one parent who was very insistent that she wanted to live in the dorm room with the daughter. And that was something that we could not offer because we wanted to offer the daughter the authentic experience of living with roommates and things like that. So think about what you may or may not be able to do and what you might be ready for. And as well, and think about the degree to which you'd like to be involved in the student's experience. All right, this is now miscellaneous stuff that I think we should think about as we round out the webinar, excuse me. All right, this is something we often don't think about, but I encourage all family members to think about this. What is the dating policy or relationship policy? Can the students date each other? Do the students date each other? Is there a sexuality education course that is explicitly taught to the students? Is there a focus on that? Do they expect students to come in with that knowledge? What kind of employment experiences do the students engage in? Where do they have their internships? What do they do? How long do they have their internships? Does the internship change? Is there a job guaranteed? And more importantly, will they help you and the child find a job right before graduation? Will they link you somewhere so they're set for when they graduate? What does support after graduation look like? Let's say the student is not able to find a job or they want to work on additional skills. Is there support after graduation? And then are there times when the students won't have access to program staff, especially for residential programs? Will they have access to staff at night? What does an emergency look like? Is the washing machine not working at 2 a.m. an emergency? Or if when an emergency does happen, who responds and do the students know the protocols or will they be taught the protocols to respond to campus police and X, Y, Z? So while this program offers a lot of community support, academic support, think about what adulthood goals we really want to continue working on throughout this experience to ensure that the young adult is prepared for a meaningful lifetime ahead, right? It's not just ending at college or ending at high school or all of these, but continuously taught to them as they get older and they, you know, make more decisions independently and things like that. So this is kind of a holistic view of IPSE programs. Hopefully we were able to provide you with the start to finish of what they look like, what they might offer, how to apply, and then some good questions for you to consider and put in your toolbox when you are exploring IPSE programs in the future. Again, my name is Sarah Shikarpuria. I'm an assistant professor of special education. I've worked with IPSE programs for many years now, and I'm just so delighted to be here. So please feel free to email me if you have any questions, and I'm more than happy to chat afterward. Thank you.
I just have a question about like starting slowly. I know that, you know, we do often recommend starting slowly, like if, especially if the higher education option is going to be to the university or community college, even if it is with accommodations. The Social Security Administration says that a full-time course load is 8 hours, even though we're programmed to know that it's 12 hours. But sometimes I always like to suggest that it's okay to get out of the box. Like, you know, you don't necessarily have to do the 8 hours. If your student can do the first college course, whatever the name of it is, like introduction to college courses or university studies, which is basically telling them or teaching them how to be a good student and how to succeed in higher education. It is a 4-credit class. Maybe that's the only class they take the first semester. It's okay. But I think what concerns me is sometimes, you know, we're looking around and looking what everybody else is doing, and then we load them up with 8 hours or 12 hours, and we're starting them with both hands behind their back. Whereas if we do one or two courses, then they could get an A in it and have some success and be motivated that, hey, next semester, I think I could handle 2 courses or something like that, and like build up the success as opposed to overwhelm at first and have some major failures that they start to feel like, forget it, I can't do it. And is that a possibility in these programs that you're talking about, or not really?
Yeah, especially for IPSE programs, they will only offer 1 course a semester. And then they do these seminars that are provided by the program staff where they talk about like how to make friends in college, how to get a good grade, how do you set a timer so that you don't run late to class? Even how do you dress for class? How do you dress for appropriate weather? All of those things will be taught at semester courses. So students might take, let's say, 2 courses, but one of them isn't typically, and also these courses are academically inclusive. So they are in classrooms alongside other students, undergrad, graduate, whatever they might be. And so the whole focus is more so on inclusion and not so much on getting a good grade, essentially.
Sure. Like even just navigating on how to get accommodations and working with the Office of Disability and things like that. All of those things count. One thing that you mentioned earlier, and we always like to mention this as well, was the FERPA. And we've heard it 100 times. Well, I pay the bill. What do you mean you won't talk to me? Well, it's the law. The FERPA is the law. And so even though you pay the bill, the FERPA is necessary. But one thing I would also suggest is considering a power of attorney and a healthcare power of attorney for both your students with a disability that are not under guardianship and neurotypical students that, you know, that don't have a disability. I think it's a really good, important document to have in place, those legal documents of just in case there could be an accident. I know we had a client that had a student at the apartment fire at Texas State. We've seen psych holds and other things like that. So we always do recommend that is a consideration that families make as well. One person said, could you please just, and I know we're almost out of time, but I think we have time for this. Could you please elaborate on the deceased parent waivers?
Yeah, some IPSE programs, if they have the CTP designation, which means they receive some federal funds, they may or may not, depending, offer reduced cost for students that might have a parent in the military, as well as a parent who might have, or a caregiver who might have deceased. So this is a good question to ask and see if that is available within the program.
For sure. And one of the things, I've done a lot of research on various scholarships, and we actually do have a webinar on our YouTube channel, on higher education for kids with disabilities. And we talk about a lot of the funding and scholarships on that one. And I generally say, if you can think it up, you know, the diagnosis, there's probably a scholarship out there. So researching early about the diagnosis that your child has, or multiple diagnoses, sometimes there's even scholarships for siblings that have a sibling with that diagnosis. So looking at those programs, knowing when those applications open and when they close. I find it frustrating that they're all different for our inconvenience. but knowing when they open and close is something that is definitely worth looking into. And I always remind folks that anybody that has an adopted child through the DPFS, through the state of Texas adoption agency or foster system, those kids go to state colleges in Texas for free. And so you can reach out to that agency as well. But there are a ton of opportunities for, you know, getting some of these things paid for, but you have to be clever. You need to have a spreadsheet. You need to know your deadlines and follow those things to a T. And the other thing that I would recommend too is when If you are going to, you know, a regular university program that is going to require essays, I suggest having your student work on those essays over the summer, because, you know, maybe it's the summer they're going to be a senior this year or whatever that summer, because senior year comes fast and furious, and there's a lot of requirements and a lot of stressors, and especially with all these applications and other things like that. And having those essays relatively ready, because you can get those essay prompts online, will make it easy for your student to be able to edit those essays quickly and send them off, as opposed to laboring over them. And I know with my kids, you know, we're out of that college phase, but there were many, many tears with essays.
And adding to what Allison shared, you can also print some of these application forms on their website. They have them available. And then take them to your IEPR team and say, this is a goal. I want you to work on this with my student, and gather progress and have them do it over and over again for practice, as well as have them practice interviews with the IEP team. This is a goal, and I think it should be reflected in the IEP document and transition planning too.
For sure. The last thing that I want to say, and you mentioned earlier, you know, we don't want parents writing essays or doing everything for the student. The other thing that I will mention, if you're new at this and this is your first student, you're going to higher education, I will also say that this is not a job for them and them alone. Just for instance, the FAFSA, they can't complete the FAFSA without you. They need your financial information. There's a lot of parental input. So saying, just do that application or get this done. It's not as easy as one might think. And to me, it could be a lot easier than what they make it, but parental involvement, they're just basically saying, don't do the essay, but it is going to be critical for their success. And I would argue that that is true for a neurotypical kid too, not just a kid with a disability. They've never done this before, and it's hard to look at. And I know that sometimes a lot of parents feel stressed when they're looking at all of this, but there's help out there. So thank you. It has been a pleasure, and what a great presentation. So again, for everybody that attended today, thank you. You're going to get a copy of today's slides, and the link to the presentation will also live on our Consolidated Planning Group YouTube channel that you can subscribe to for free. Any of the other webinars on higher education for people with disabilities are out there. We have also partnered with Jody Glau in the past, and she is a special education, higher education consultant that a person can hire. So if you wanted to hire a professional help on your journey with this, she's out there as well. So thank you, certainly been our pleasure, and we will look forward to partnering with you again in the future. Take care, have a great afternoon, everyone.